This podcast is intended for investment professionals only. All investing involves risk.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us this afternoon. Alongside its profound human and political consequences, the conflict in the Middle East has prompted significant moves across markets. As such, we're holding this webinar today to focus purely on the implications for investors of this fast-moving situation. We'll also share how we're positioning to manage risk and meet our clients' long-term objectives. I'm joined today by Chris Jeffrey, who is co-head of multi-asset, Colin Reedy, who is head of active strategies, and Jason Shoup, who is our US CIO. First of all, I'm going to ask Chris, can you please walk us through the economic impact of recent events? We've seen the knee-jerk moves higher in energy prices and lower in equity prices. Do they reflect an overreaction or are they an appropriate reappraisal of fundamentals?
Thanks, Laura, for my question. I think it really depends, well, the fundamental impact really depends on how long the Straits of Hormuz are shut. It's a narrow choke point in the world's trading system, about as wide as the English Channel, and around 20% of the world's oil supply, around 20% of the liquefied natural gas supply, and about 20% of internationally traded fertilizer all flows through the strait. It is effectively shut as of now because of the risks to maritime passage that are kind of so obvious from the conflict. Not all of the oil is stuck. There are pipelines that allow both Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates to bypass the straits. But gas is the real problem. The gas supply, largely coming from Qatar, cannot move. The size of the gas price shock is pretty big. It's about 50 to 60% if we look out along the forward curve in European markets. But gas is not globally integrated. The impact in the US gas market is close to zero. And that's how it's been reflected in broader market impact. So 5 to 6% off European equities, barely a ripple when we look at US equities. If we think about the credit markets, some, albeit modest moves, wider in European spreads, next to nothing in the US. So that looks like a market which is discerning between the place where the economic impact is likely to be most significant and the place where the economic impact is not. But inevitably makes people think back to what happened in 2022 with the Russian invasion of Ukraine. I think it's important just to have the kind of context there that allows us to think about that relative to the Ukraine shock. So in 2022, European gas prices moved higher by over 1,000%. It was absolutely enormous price shock. What we've seen so far as a consequence of what's happening in the Middle East, as I said, a sort of 50% type move higher in gas prices. It is not of the same order of magnitude in terms of its economic impact, and markets are not pricing it in that way either. So far, it looks like a pretty rational rather than kind of knee-jerk response to what has happened.
Really interesting. Thank you. And that price difference in the shock is remarkable. Colin, turning to you and to credit, what do you see as the likely consequences for credit markets, including emerging market debt? And how are these affecting your positioning at the moment? And are you thinking differently about some of the tail risks?
Thanks, Laura. It's been a bit surprising, to be honest with you. I mean, so far, pretty much all the action has been in government bond markets, not credit so much. With the exception of a couple of sort of small pockets of the credit markets that you would expect to have widened this week, spreads are actually tighter. And that's almost entirely down to the move higher in risk-free yields. Because, I mean, normally, you know, in these settings, the safe haven bit overwhelms the transitory, you know, impact from higher oil prices, but not this time. And that has surprised us. And in trying to sort of figure out what might be going on here, you know, we look back to February, you know, government bonds had a really strong period. 10-year treasuries were 30 basis points lower. So maybe we were a little bit more braced for war than we thought. you know, credit at the time, and this is still a theme, was sort of preoccupied with the impact of AI on financial markets sort of more broadly, because in response to that, lower government yield, credit spreads actually widened by, you know, a good 15% or so. So at the moment, it's relatively calm. I think the key point, you know, Chris has already made, and we'll touch on it several times, I would imagine, during the call. And it's really about how long this lasts from here. You know, we had a bit of back and forth over the weekend after the news, and I said if oil prices, you know, spiked through $100, it wouldn't spook me if it, you know, so long as they came back down and it was a relatively short affair. I would be much more concerned if oil was above $80 a barrel for like 2 months. That then the impact would be felt much, much more broadly across the whole sort of credit spectrum. EMD is probably very sensitive here, just given that it's in oil. The team do think the consequences are potentially, you know, quite far reaching if the energy markets sort of remain extended for that meaningful period of time. They're worried about knock-on implications for inflation, Fed price cuts, Fed rate cuts, and what have you. And the dollar, the local currency EM trade, which is effectively short dollar, long EM, would come under threat at that point. And there is a lot of money in that trade. And it's been very fashionable for the last year or so. And you know, furthermore, if currently perceived Fed cuts are no longer expected, then, you know, the impact of that is again probably much more broad for credit markets at that point. So it's really wait and see for the time being.
Yeah, that's an interesting point on the dollar side, and I guess that gives me an opportunity to bring in Jason with that on the ground in the US perspective. The markets has clearly been largely pricing this as a European and Asian market issue so far. The dollar's rallied, US equities have outperformed. How long can US financial markets stay relatively calm in the face of volatility elsewhere?
Yeah, thanks, Laura. And a lot of my comments echo precisely what Colin has just gone through. I think away from the obvious reasons for outperformance, which I would say relate to U.S. energy independence and the dollar as a reserve currency, if you put those to the side for a minute, I have a few thoughts on why we've maybe seen markets behave in the way they have in the U.S. The first one is really about the setup of the U.S. markets heading into this week's events, right? And some of that was already touched on by Colin, but U.S. equities and credit had both been working through, you know, and grappling with quite significant concerns around AI disruption ahead of any of the geopolitical risks that have now unfolded. And how had that really been treated by markets? I think a couple of things. One, you'd seen a very big rotation so far this year in equities out of software, out of tech companies, into more defensive sectors. And in that defensive sector category, sectors that are less disruptible to AI, let's say, I would put energy. So energy had already been a beneficiary of a rotation on the back of AI before anything happened to the oil price related to the events of the last week. The second thing I would point to is something that Colin mentioned, the credit just in general had been widening, credit spreads, investment grade and high yield on the same concerns. But you, of course, seen it with, you know, the business development companies, the software companies, all of that exposure being worked through throughout the credit complex. And then I think the third thing, which I'm sure we're going to elaborate a little bit more on in the coming questions, is that treasury yields came into March, if you will, at a much lower level in yield terms than you might have otherwise expected, right? Given the kind of data that we've seen and the robustness of the data we've seen in the US over the first 2 months of the year. And I think that also has something to do with AI and investors maybe looking through some of those, that hotter than expected data and not necessarily translating into a higher yield environment. Second point I would make is that rates do matter for credit, as Colin mentioned. It's worth just pointing out that even with this higher yield environment that we've seen that was surprising to so many that it unfolded, it's not really meaningfully out of the range of where yields have traded, right, over the course of the last, 2 to 5 months. So I would say that if I'm thinking about the stability of U.S. asset markets, a breakout in any direction from yields outside the kind of recent range is going to be meaningful as a signal. And we haven't seen that yet. And then the last thing I would say, coming back to maybe EM and other asset classes and how the U.S. markets tend to react when they react poorly to events like that we've seen. Oftentimes you see what I would call is sort of liquidity contagion in markets. Very, 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 investment manager, PM-centric view of the world, I'll admit. But when you're looking at your portfolio and you suddenly discover you're overexposed to a risk that you may want to not be as exposed to, the natural inclination is maybe to lighten up on that risk. Markets aren't always cooperative in those situations, and sometimes you can't sell what you want to sell. You end up selling what you can sell in your portfolio. And that's a mechanism that we've seen time and time again play out in a way in which liquidity ends up, propagating risks through the system. So that's something I'm watching for very closely with respect to emerging markets.
That's fascinating. And I guess from what's been said so far, it's the classic thing of the features of different crises kind of echo through. But every crisis is different in terms of how the impacts manifest. With that in mind, Chris, going back to rates and government bond yields, usually equity markets are weak. We expect government bond yields to fall in a time of elevated risk. That hasn't happened, as we've said, in the last few days. What are your thoughts on what's going on? And are you concerned about what this means and its wider implications?
It did happen, but it happened for about an hour during the early morning in Japan. And then we kind of saw a reversal. And I think that's a phenomenon we've seen a few times now over the course of the last few years in response to these sorts of supply shocks. But the period in which we get the knee-jerk kind of flight to safety has just got shorter and shorter and shorter. So kind of why is that? Maybe first of all, just kind of step back and say, well, how big has been the move higher in government bond yields? I mean, just as the gas price moves are much smaller than in 2022 and the equity price moves are much smaller, the government bond yield moves are much smaller as well. We're talking maybe 15 to 20 basis points. So not kind of outside the normal bounds of volatility in that market, as Jason was alluding to. But the kind of characteristic of what we've seen is inevitably something that puts upward pressure on inflation. Now, we don't know how long it will last, and I'm sure we will get into a conversation which is reminiscent of a few years ago where people are having a discussion about how transitory or otherwise will the inflation shock be. But it's certainly the case that directionally it puts upward pressure. We've seen the short end of inflation curves in Europe and the UK. So the market's price for inflation over the course of the next couple of years has moved higher by a pretty meaningful amount. So 40 to 50 basis points at a one-year horizon. And it just becomes very hard to imagine central banks continuing to cut rates in that environment. The kind of setup going into last weekend was a market that in the UK was priced for the Bank of England to be cutting rates a couple of times over the course of the year, with the trader narrative that supported that being, well, it's almost inevitable that inflation is going to fall in April as we kind of roll into the new tax year and certain one-off effects drop out, and that lower inflation will create the space to be cutting rates. That's just a much harder argument to make now. You've injected such a large kind of step change in commodity pricing. I think there's a separate question, which is kind of equally important. Does that mean that government bonds stop playing a useful role in portfolios? Now, if we go through, having been through a couple of supply shocks in the last few years where they haven't been particularly useful portfolio insurance, does that mean they are not useful portfolio insurance going forwards? I feel like that would be a mistake to kind of jump from one from one extreme to another. We know that in the event of a aggregate demand shock, in the event of a credit event that makes central banks reach for that monetary policy lever and be talking about kind of cutting rates, then those are the environments where government bonds are an extremely important form of portfolio insurance. We just kind of think back to this kind of step change lower in yields that we saw during the COVID shock in 2020. It's not going to take much, and I think Jason and Colin have both pointed out this already, it's not going to take much for bond investors to switch back from thinking about events in the Middle East to thinking about the events that were preoccupying their minds during February. And the story in February was one of AI-related disruption and what are the disinflationary consequences of that in the medium term. One other thing, I think, and I'm going to stop. One other thing that we just need to remember is that we are going through a leadership transition at the Federal Reserve. It's undoubtedly got lost amongst all the headlines in the last 24 hours. But Kevin Warsh's nomination was formally submitted to the Senate yesterday. So at some point over the course of the next couple of weeks, we're going to start having Senate testimony from Kevin Warsh to digest, and that will become an important driver of bond yields. So yes, during this kind of this period of short, sharp shock to energy prices, we've had the bond market focus on that, but it won't take much to be kind of focusing back on the reaction function with Kevin Warsh or that AI-related disruption that was so important in February.
Yes, it's certainly not been a quiet start to 2026 in terms of some of these challenges. Colin, what's your view in terms of inflation? And we've seen relatively large moves, as we said, in expectations, particularly in the UK and Europe. We've spoken about echoes of previous crises. 2022 springs to mind. Should investors be worried about a repeat?
I think I'd tend to side with Chris here. It's always different, although cycles will rhyme and a historical frame of reference is always useful. I mean, the conventional thinking says that, you know, central banks should look through any sort of temporary sort of supply shock. But Chris makes a great point about, you know, change of leadership and maybe different thinking. Who knows? But higher headline inflation, full stop, makes it harder to sort of cut interest rates. And I think that's what's been the key driver of the move higher in government bond yields that we've seen this week, is just investors changing their assumptions as to rate cuts, when, how many, you know, and whether you're going to see them at all. And then, you know, there's the way the narrative can develop in markets, the higher inflation goes, the bigger the risk that inflation expectations get de-anchored and so on. And, you know, this has to be set against the backdrop of a large amount of period where inflation has been above target. So yeah, this is a live topic, I have to say. But, you know, the key question is tough to answer, and that's obviously how long is this going to go on for. But if we just park, you know, oil for a second, you know, global, and with the exception of China, maybe global growth looks okay. Yeah, I mean, Japan is overheating, Europe's picking up steam, most of EM is in good shape, and the world is enjoying lower rates at the moment. And loose fiscal policy. Don't forget those longer term themes, I think, are still at play in the background. But my guess is that's probably for the next webinar. Not here, not now.
We've got a question through from the audience, which I think is an interesting one, and speaks to some of the themes here. So while the conflict appears to be an extreme event with potential wide ranging implications, why is it that the markets haven't moved as much as we may have expected them to move? I guess it's that sense of, is there almost crisis fatigue? We've had so many now that there's a, you know, almost a feeling, and this is really the question, what is giving investors the comfort that things are not as bad as they might seem? Jason, do you want to pick that one up?
Yeah, I guess I have one thought there that kind of springs to mind. I do think, you know, after you've seen Venezuela, after you've seen the weekend's, you know, this week's events, It seems logical to expect, just extrapolating, that there could be, you know, more geopolitical events on the horizon going forward. But what's, I think the question gets to is, it's really unclear what that means for investors in the U.S. or elsewhere. We have seen for now a few years a really aggressive behavioral component to markets, where dips get bought very, very quickly, and they don't last very long. And Chris mentioned this with yields. The flight to quality bid lasted for about an hour, and then, you know, completely reversed, and has been, you know, moving in the other direction for the last 3 days, 4 days. I think that's one reason why markets aren't seeing so much volatility, is that there is this aggressive response to buy any dips the minute they appear. Why is there this aggressive response? I think in the last, you know, certainly since Liberation Day, there's been a view that at least in the U.S. administration, they're paying attention to financial markets, and that at least the performance of financial markets has some impact on policy and how policy might evolve going forward. And I think that that could be very true with respect to this week, or at least in the minds of investors. Whether it's accurate or inaccurate is that if there was to be significant damage to the U.S. market, maybe there would be a change of tact that would be employed. I think if you take a step back, if that's the dynamic that you're seeing in the market, it clearly does create the risk of a policy mistake, because you won't necessarily get the feedback mechanism that you think from markets that they should be providing to you based on the risks. If there's a view that the, you know, policy will be adjusting to markets, a very circularity kind of problem to come to grips with.
That's really, really interesting. And it does feel like it's increasingly a game of four-dimensional chess in terms of trying to anticipate the different moves. I guess, Chris, in the multi-asset team, how are we thinking about this? How are we managing that sort of dynamic? And, you know, how might a protracted conflict affect your thinking versus a briefer engagement? Sounds a little bit like the perennial question of transitory inflation from previous discussions. But yeah, what are you thinking about this? How are you sorting through the factors and changing the positioning?
Yeah, so we're not changing much in response to events of the last few days. We've been doing some things kind of around the edges in our dynamically managed funds on some currency exposure and some sector exposure. But in terms of the kind of big asset sort of risk levers, how do we think about credit? How do we think about equities? Not doing much. And I think the main reason is, in order to believe that even a kind of protracted conflict has a material impact, you need to think of what's the channel to earnings and what's the channel to default rates when thinking about equity and credit, respectively. Now, clearly, there is a scenario where you have a very material kind of earnings and default impact if we're talking about a repeat of the 2022 type shock. But when we kind of think about, well, what's the factors that have been keeping markets buoyant? Yes, there's the behavior aspect that Jason has been speaking to, but there's a kind of core fundamental factor as well, which is we've just seen five consecutive quarters of double-digit earnings growth in the US. That investors are increasingly confident that earnings growth is going to spread from the US to the other parts of the world, driven by fiscal stimulus, which perhaps ironically is in part driven by security and defense concerns. So the more uncertain kind of geopolitical world of the last 12 months has been the catalyst for European governments to open the purse strings, which in turn is supporting kind of European earnings expectations. So unless the conflict becomes sufficiently disruptive that we think that there's a material kind of risk to the earnings outlook in one of the major economies, then it's something that is unlikely to make us think about kind of large changes in our equity allocation. And then the thing that would make that stop being true is it would kind of go right back to where we started. If we did see things that looked and smelt like overreaction, that had stopped being kind of a rational repricing on the back of factors which differentially impact different markets. If we saw that, then then that becomes a sort of interesting trigger for changing how we're allocating. But we don't see any of that yet.
We've got another related question. So maybe one for you, Jason, in terms of, does the dollar's move undermine recent narratives that have been questioning its status as a safe haven currency? I know we've talked about this on previous webinars. Or is it just playing into the fact that the US seems more isolated from wider market impacts from these events in particular?
Yeah, I kind of come back to the very first comment I made on the dollar. And I'm not a dollar expert. You might get a really insightful answer from Chris, too. I think the setup matters. The dollar had been very weak, you know, for a period of time up until these recent events. There was definitely a consensus expectation that it might continue to weaken, albeit more gradually going forward as some of the enthusiasm for U.S. assets broadened out more globally, right? And you have seen, you know, prominent fixed income managers, for instance, talk about the attractiveness of emerging markets debt and upping, you know, the allocations within their portfolios. And so some of the moves that we've seen right away are just a reflection of where positioning was with respect to the dollar and where sentiment was with respect to the dollar. And I can think of few events that crystallize one's opinion on the reserve currency as much as, you know, geopolitical conflict. And so it was sort of ripe, I think, for a little bit of a unwind of some of the weakness that we've previously seen.
Thank you. Colin, this is one I'd love to get your view on. So one thought from one of our audience members is that European markets are likely to suffer more than the US due to the requirement of Europe to import oil and gas. And therefore, that, you know, the perspective there is, how big a driver do we think that is? And is there a tactical advantage because of that in increasing exposure to the US in any sectors or asset classes?
Yeah, well, one underappreciated risk would be the EU's still large dependency on Russian gas. I mean, that could easily be cut off, pushing sort of EU power prices materially higher, you know, maybe not to the order of magnitude Chris was mentioning earlier, but I mean, that would be a real unhelpful, unleft field development. The thing to work through now is where else does this touch? Because energy touches everything. It's like a river going sort of down tributaries and all the rest of it. You know, it's other areas that we are sort of focused on from a risk perspective is sort of Qatar LNG operations are being closed. Oil and refined products sort of could follow. It will take time to sort of restart production. So price normalization might be protracted. Estimates are around 2 weeks or something, I believe. But that could be optimistic, I guess, given what's going on. There are, you know, to the EU point, there are sort of downstream impacts of higher EU energy prices in you know, some of the sectors that are already under pressure or challenged. You know, we would highlight sort of paper and packaging, cement, chemicals in these areas. Airline fuel, you know, it's an important global fuel product markets, petrol and diesel. So anyone who's unhedged might have issues here. I believe Singapore jet fuel, for example, has gone up over 100%. It touches everything, and you really have to sort of like look through sector by sector to see what the impact could potentially be. I'm not sure just running away from a geographic area is that sensible a move, but I can understand the sentiment.
Thank you. Chris, one for you, I think. Given the current energy-driven inflation pressures and the counteracting disinflationary effects of AI, how realistic is the risk of stagflation in the current environment?
I think we've got to sort of define what we mean by stagflation. So is it realistic to expect a period where inflation rises and growth slows? Absolutely. I mean, when you have a supply shock that hits parts of the world which have large energy imbalances. That's Europe and Japan and developed Asia. Then that terms of trade shock will likely play through in that way. We will likely see kind of currency adjustment to re-equilibrate FX markets. That currency adjustment will help soften the blow on the growth side, but it only softens the blow on the growth side materially if that's associated by an increase in exports, which kind of offsets. And obviously, I mean, it, totally independent of what's been going on over the last week, it's not exactly been an easy time for world trade with the tariff-related uncertainty that's kind of ever-present at the moment. So if we define stagflation as that short-term period of inflation higher and growth weaker, absolutely. More meaningfully, though, I'd say kind of people associate that with a protracted period where inflation is kind of untethered from the growth environment. They kind of think of the 1970s where weak growth for a multi-year period was associated with very high inflation for a multi-year period. I don't think that's likely. I think the central banks that went through 2022 are once bitten and twice shy, that they will not be using the kind of terminology that they were using last time. They will not be as slow to react to the a supposed one-off kind of pickup in prices as they were last time. So the chance of getting genuinely dislodged inflation expectations, which reverberate round and round the system with higher prices, leading to higher wages, leading to higher prices, I think is just not is not a risk which I've attached much weight to. You know, we got very close to that in 2022, and people will not want to go back there.
Thank you. And I think that's probably a good place to leave it. So thank you very much to the speakers today. That's been incredibly interesting and helpful to try to make sense of what's going on. It feels like we are subject to such significant forces, AI, geopolitics, that, you know, trying to make sense of it all, but maintaining that long-term risk management perspective is ever more important. Just wanted to finish by saying that, of course, many of us know people in the region who are directly affected by the conflict, or those disrupted in terms of travel. You know, it's obviously an incredibly difficult time, and we sincerely hope that our clients, families, and everybody's colleagues, wherever they are, remain safe and are able to return to normality as soon as possible.
As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. The views expressed in this podcast are those of L&G's Asset Management Division as at the date of publication. This podcast is for informational purposes only, and we're not soliciting any action based on it. The information discusses general market, economic or political issues, or industry or sector trends. It does not constitute research or investment, legal or tax advice. It is not recommendation or advertisement to buy or sell securities or pursue a particular investment strategy. Assumptions, opinions, and estimates are provided for illustrative purposes only. There is no guarantee that any forecast made will come to pass. No party shall have any right of action against L&G in relation to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Where this podcast contains third-party information, the accuracy or completeness of such information cannot be guaranteed, and we accept no responsibility or liability in respect of such information, not for distribution to any person in any jurisdiction where such distribution would be contrary to local law or regulations. Copyright 2025. Legal and General Investment Management Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. Unless otherwise stated, references herein to L&G, we and us are meant to capture the global conglomerate that includes, in the European Economic Area, LGIM Managers Europe Limited, authorised and regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland as a UCITS management company pursuant to European Communities Undertaking for Collective Investment in Transferable Securities Regulations 2011 as amended, and as an Alternative Investment Fund Manager pursuant to the European Union Alternative Investment Fund Managers Regulations 2013 as amended. In the USA, Legal and General Investment Management America, Inc., a US SEC regulated investment advisor. In Japan, Legal and General Investment Management Japan, KK, a Japan FSA registered investment management company. In Hong Kong, issued by Legal and General Investment Management Asia Limited, which is licensed by the Securities and Futures Commission. And in Singapore, issued by LGIM Singapore Pte Limited, company registration number 20223187 6W, which is regulated by the Monetary Authority of Singapore. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more content, you can check us out on LinkedIn or on our website.